Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
Yo!
How are you, man?
I'm good. How's the weekend?
The weekend was long. I just really just longed back to work, and I came in yesterday and started editing.
Literally, the proper answer is fine, Howard. This is your show. Let's get on with it.
Okay. Fine, Howard. This is your show. Please go on.
we have a great guest today, so we're just going to get right to it. Chetan.
Excellent.
Puttaganta. I don't know. He's going to correct me on that. He said to just say it fast. Chetan Puttaganta. Sounds Indian, I think. He looks 11. I haven't met Chetan, but follow his work in open source investing. He's a benchmark. So rarely do we get people like this to come on the show, because we're usually... Oh, there's my dog on the show as well, barking. Rarely do we get VCs from the top tier firms, because a lot of stuff of what they do is a little over my head. But Chetan is an open source investor, went to Stanford, and is on the board of some great companies that I'm interested in. He was on the board of MuleSoft, which got acquired by Salesforce. MuleSoft was a stock that I own, and Ross Mason's coming on the Panic with Friends right after in the next episode. And now on the board of Elastic, one of my larger positions, which is a open source search product. So I'm going to ask him a bunch of questions, because I'm curious about what, yeah. People sent me a list of questions to ask them, but I'm saying, like, get Chetan on your own podcast. I'm asking him questions for me. Is that okay with you, Knut?
Absolutely. It's your show.
All right. One more time. How was your weekend?
Fantastic. How was yours?
Really? That's it? Nothing happened? All right. Let's get Chetan on the horn.
Hi.
Chetan.
Hey, Howard.
Big day for you.
Yes, it is. I'm on your show.
So does anybody at Benchmark know you're doing this, or are you just breaking the law?
We're just doing it so early that I'm hoping that we just finished up before anybody realizes that I'm on your show.
So this will be a little different. I have my own curiosities, obviously, and just randomly and seeing you on Twitter. I think we follow each other. Well, I don't know how we followed each other or found each other, but been listening. You know, Benchmark's such a great firm. We'll talk a little bit about that. But, you know, I have my own selfish questions as a shareholder. I was a small world shareholder in a bunch of stock at the acquisition in MuleSoft. I didn't know you were on the board there. And then you're on the board of Elastic, one of my favorite companies. So it's just like, it's cool. I'm not really going to ask you about the stock or revenue, et cetera, just more background on the companies. And Benchmark itself. Where were you born, and how do you pronounce your last name?
So I'm originally from India. I grew up all over the U.S. Actually, I grew up. We spent a bunch of time in Utah, and then I primarily grew up in Maryland in the D.C. suburbs. And then I've been in California now for almost 20 years, and it's Puttaganta.
Puttaganta, and do you ski?
I snowboard. Okay. Not particularly well. I do think that for somebody that, you know, spent a ton of time in Utah, I'm not very good at it if you calibrate it based on that benchmark. But Utah's a lovely place, and still have a lot of family friends that live there. And it's, of course, a lovely place to go ski.
Code for I hardly go home. So, but, you know, no judgment. The first question, you're young. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 34.
Are you the youngest partner ever at Benchmark?
I think there have been people that have joined the firm in their early 30s before.
Okay. So you don't know much company history, so that's good to know.
There isn't an archive book in the lobby or anything for me to go read.
It's so funny. I went to the website. There's nothing there. This takes me to your companies. Like, it's such a bold, I forgot that that happens. What, and to give people a little bit of background on Benchmark, it's such a great firm.
Yeah, we're primarily an early stage firm. So the firm was founded in 1995, been around for quite some time. What's really unique about the firm itself is that we're five equal partners and everything is sort of split evenly. And we're a $425 million fund that primarily invests the early stages. One of the unique things about the firm is that we invest, call it 5 to 10 times a year total. And every time we invest, we take a board seat. And so it's a firm commitment every time we invest. We primarily invest, I would say, at the very inception of a company. So, you know, the vast majority of what we do, call it 90% of the investments we make, are either the very first round that the company raises or the second round. So in today's world, it's, you know, called a seed is the initial round, or maybe sometimes called a pre-seed, depending on your favorite terminology. And the second round is often called a seed or a series A. And so that's primarily where we're getting involved. I personally spend my time mostly in B2B, enterprise software, open source, infrastructure, et cetera. But we as a firm invest in everything. So we invest in consumer, we invest very rarely in hardware, but primarily it's mostly software, and that's where the world is going, certainly. But in the consumer side, social media, marketplaces, et cetera, and my partners have invested in companies like Twitter, Uber, Snap, Instagram, Discord, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, on the enterprise side, anywhere from applications to infrastructure and everything in between.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing history. And how long have you been at Benchmark? 3 years?
2 years. So I joined summer of 2018. So it's been a little over 2 years.
And where'd they recruit you out of? NEA?
Yeah, that's right. So before joining Benchmark, I was a general partner in NEA. And really got to know Benchmark through Elastic. So I served on the board of Elastic, and I still do serve on the board of Elastic with my partner, Peter. So I joined the board of Elastic in 2014 and met Peter through that. And, you know, he's an extraordinary board member, and I've just been really lucky to call him one of my mentors. And really got to know Peter, really got to know the firm through that experience. And that was sort of the genesis.
And are you... I'm curious about a bunch of things here. What, just as quick a definition as you can, because people, I'll link people to the Patrick O'Shaughnessy podcast where you go deeper into open source. What is open source for a public? What you know, you hear this term thrown around a lot. So my aunt's a lot of public investors, and a lot of people I know own the stock. What is open source and what isn't?
Yeah. So let's start sort of at a higher level, and like you mentioned before, I've been involved in open source for quite some time. So I was on the board of MuleSoft, I was on the board of Mongo, obviously on the board of Elastic, and then a number of others like Acquia and so on. The central idea of open source is that there is some component of it, usually the core, that is open to the public, including the source code itself. And so you're essentially allowing developer communities around the world to experiment, prototype, and essentially start working on it and using it in production without sort of any commercial agreement with the underlying company that's responsible for the open source project. And then as that code is moved into production and as you're leveraging it for your product or your application or whatever, you then create offerings, whether it's enterprise offerings where you can run this open source project on your own servers, or a cloud offering where you can pay the commercial entity to essentially provide a managed service of that open source software. So if you look at something like MongoDB, there's two primary business models, and one that's come to dominate in recent years, which is MongoDB Atlas, which is their cloud managed service of MongoDB. And that's growing around 66% a year and has crossed well over $200 million run rate. And that's just happened in 4 years since launch. And so the cloud service of MongoDB is now really growing much faster than the other side of MongoDB where they monetize, which is the enterprise offering, which is a whole lot of software tools for enterprises to run MongoDB in their own data centers or on their own servers and stuff like that. And as more workloads are moving to the cloud, MongoDB is, of course, riding that wave with MongoDB Atlas. And similarly, other open source companies have similar business models. So there's usually either, it used to be mostly monetizing on-premise workloads, but as more workloads have moved to the cloud, almost every open source company now has a managed open source managed service in the cloud that's usually the primary driver of monetization.
And how big a company do you think, at what size company do you use Mongo a choice?
You know, what's really interesting is that from the early days of MongoDB, so I got involved in MongoDB, I met them in late 2011 and joined the board in 2012. From the beginning of MongoDB, one of the things that was very cool about it was that you could use it and get into a prototype phase very, very fast. So you can prototype an application on MongoDB. And, you know, if you're a large enterprise, you could sort of show it off internally. And if you were an independent application developer, you could get it up and running and show your either clients or, you know, launch it or whatever very quickly. And so from the beginning, it was really interesting to watch the behavior of the user base of MongoDB in that it sort of spanned all the way from independent solo developers all the way to the biggest customers in the world or the biggest companies in the world that were using it to just move a little bit faster. And so I think this is part of the power of open source software, which is that from the beginning, you start to see developers that come from sort of a wide range of commercial entities. And that access to distribution is particularly fascinating to me and I think is pretty spectacular.
And do you think the CEO, what's his name? He's a badass. What's the CEO's name of Mongo?
David Acharya.
So when he started it, why do you think, because that's a big choice, like locking it down versus open sourcing it. Why did he think it could be a public company? What's his thinking at the beginning, way back when, of open source at that time?
Yeah, so the founder of Mongo was Elliot Horowitz, and they've joined Mongo a few years later. And if you go back to sort of the genesis of Elliot's story and Elliot's creation of MongoDB, Elliot actually was an engineer at DoubleClick way back in the day. And it was through that experience he saw very clearly the limitations of your traditional relational database and really thought about how do we make the process of development much faster and much more agile and sort of all the buzzwords you hear today. But he was thinking about this in 2007, 2008. And what was pretty clear, you know, call it 10, 15 years ago, was that the way you were going to get access to developers to try a new database was through open source. And the precedent had been set with MySQL several years before that, which funny enough happens to be a benchmark investment. But the precedent had been kind of set with MySQL in that a new database could really break out and become a new standard using open source. And so with that precedent out there, and of course MySQL, you know, ended up getting bought by Sun for about $1 billion, and then Oracle bought Sun, so MySQL ended up with Oracle. And that precedent had been set. And so when MongoDB was released, it was following that precedent that open source was the way for developers to try a brand new database. And then almost, you know, in a couple of years, it started taking off. Like, there were people that were using it that were startups. There were big companies that started using it. And primarily the initial use case of MongoDB, which is pretty interesting to look back on it, was a lot of people prototyping and a lot of people sort of like just getting the initial version on MongoDB and not worrying about the data schema so much and sort of getting up and running. And because of MongoDB's document-oriented data model, you could get up and running much faster on that system than something like a MySQL. So that was the initial genesis of the idea and the approach of using open source. And then the sort of monetization path actually took quite some time. You know, in 2011, 2012, the revenue was very, very modest. I mean, we're talking, you know, barely single digits, millions. And from that point onward, it was like sort of a very methodical process to build enough enterprise and monetization offerings so that the business could actually grow.
And so here we are, 2020, in an open source leadership world, you're on the board. How does it, you know, I think of it as like, I'm trying to like make it simple for myself and for people listening in. Because I don't own the Mongo. I've owned it earlier and stupidly I sold it. How do these things, like once it's going and it's open source and people are using the code and it's deeper and deeper, like a Twilio, and the revenue per customer is so high at Mongo, how does it get beaten? Now, obviously, like Amazon can threaten it and because they can. But do they have to screw it up, or is there something beyond the cloud that has to happen? How does it slow down?
So the infrastructure software is really fascinating. And we're part of a new generation of infrastructure software that's being enabled by the cloud. So, you know, going back to Mongo for a second, the cloud offering MongoDB Atlas is used by something like 18,000 customers today that are paying customers of the managed service in the cloud of Atlas. And that's just a gigantic paid user base for a database software, right? And as with every sort of phase shift in infrastructure software, you can get a long run if you deliver an appropriate product that's reliable to the customers. And along that roadmap, there are going to be constant alternatives being presented to the customers. Just like when MongoDB came out in 07, and then the alternative they presented in 08, 09, 010, and like sort of it's been grown over a period of 10, 15 years now, and it's got a lot of gravity around it, a lot of resources around it, et cetera, et cetera. That can happen sort of without anybody noticing very quickly in today's world, especially with the cloud. And part of what's happening in the cloud is that once your workloads are in the cloud, you can switch between different infrastructure providers pretty quickly if you choose to. So part of, I think, any company that's monetizing on the cloud today is that you have to continuously focus on why customers are using you and what is the value they're getting out of your service. And part of that value of service is that you continuously have to innovate on the product itself. And so if you just look at something like an Atlas product, when it came out 4 years ago versus what it is today, I mean, it is a dramatically improved product today than it was 4 years ago, as it should be. And so that's part of, you know, the huge R&D investment that these open source companies end up making into their products. I do think that one of the sort of common misconceptions about open source is that you can get a lot of leverage on your R&D by being open source. I actually think it's quite the opposite. I think open source ends up being much more expensive on your R&D because you have to not only support the open source product, but you also have to support the enterprise and cloud offering too. So you essentially are supporting multiple products for the R&D function. What you end up gaining as a result of that R&D expense or extra R&D expense is that you get the early advantage of distribution. And so you're able to access customers and companies and users much more efficiently, especially in the early days. And so that extra R&D spend you save in other places. But ultimately, like the initial outlay is quite high and continues to be high over time.
So if you invest properly, these are like monopoly potential, not illegal. I mean, the antitrust is going to have to come up with stuff like this. So if Mongo continues to invest and 18,000 becomes 30,000 and something interesting comes along, Mongo can quickly create other products, which gets me to the next question. You don't have to answer that. Is Elastic. So in a world of like these open source products, do they all just try and consume each other? Does Mongo get into search? Does Elastic get into more the Mongo business? How in an open source world, isn't it eventually everybody's got open, you know, constantly investing in growing market? Or is the market deep enough vertically that it will take years for that to happen?
Well, what's really interesting is if you take a look at Mongo's run rate revenue. So we talked about the cloud being a little over $200 million and the overall run rate of the business is, you know, call it something on the order of $500 million. This still is like really tiny compared to Oracle, right? Oracle in 2019 had something like $40 billion of revenue. And so, you know, and of course, Oracle monetizes both the applications and the database. I just think one of the things that these companies are starting to open up is just how gigantic these markets are. And so even Oracle would argue that they don't have the vast majority of the market share in the database world. And so if Oracle is monetizing on the order, and this is just a completely rough estimate just for discussion purposes, and it's probably not the actual number, but even if you assume half of Oracle's revenue is database revenue, then you're on the order of $20 billion of revenue from Oracle just on database products. And so, and you're talking about a database that came out in the 1970s. And so what ends up happening is that these markets end up being so deep that you can have five or six database companies do really, really well and never see each other in the market.
Wow. Yeah, I tell people that don't understand. I go, well, remember you used to go to Staples and Office Depot and like haul, I think he had enough storage space back in the day for 400 pounds. He'd haul a steel storage case. Now I said, multiply that times a trillion, put it in the cloud, take away all the shipping costs and all the distribution costs and the markups from retail and go, you know, the cloud. I mean, how do you value? This is why these multiples are so high right now. You got a zero interest rate world, endless money printing and COVID. And you look at the market size and no one can figure it out. No one can figure out the TAM. It's just constantly growing.
I think that's the big challenge is that we haven't really understood what the overall TAM of all of this actually is. I think one of the things is that we know that the global IT spend is on the order of $1 trillion. We know that spend is like been pretty consistently growing. It might see a dip in 2020, but it's been growing pretty consistently over a number of years. We know that the cloud penetration of that trillion is really small. We also know the software penetration of that $1 trillion is pretty small. And so you add all that up, you're like, okay, well, it becomes, for all practical purposes, the TAM sort of becomes irrelevant. It's some gigantic number. And then you kind of have to go to the second order factors and like look at actual business results of companies to say, okay, well, what are the other numbers that we can sort of like zero in on to see how big this thing actually is? And I think one of the things that you'll hear me often talk about on Twitter or on podcasts or anything like that is just to look at the rapid growth of the public cloud companies. So the three gigantic clouds in America are Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and Google Cloud Platform. And how quickly those companies have gotten to just gigantic revenue run rates and still growing at really, really fast rates. And so if you think about it, Amazon Web Services is now a little over $40 billion revenue run rate. Azure is at about $25 billion, and it's expected that Google Cloud will likely hit about $10 billion by the end of this year. So those three clouds combined are now, it's on the order of like $70 to $75 billion of run rate revenue per year. And so those companies, so those clouds have gotten really, really big, and it's not like those clouds are plateauing. And that's the really fascinating part about it all, is that all three of them are growing really fast. And it was often thought that because AWS had such a gigantic lead, that no one was actually going to displace AWS because like once you have all this stuff running on AWS, why would you like rip it off and go over to Azure? Well, it just turned out that the market was so gigantic, there was an entire set of workloads that hadn't moved to the cloud yet, and Azure could go capture them and still build a huge business. And then similarly, Google could do the same thing with their cloud platform. So it's I think that's the most instructive sort of macro example of companies just going for it in this gigantic cloud market. And then these markets end up being so big that like all three of them could naturally end up, you know, being tens of billion dollars of revenue per year and still have really healthy margins and healthy businesses, which ultimately indicates to me that the market's just super deep.
And that's the TAM, the biggest TAM trap of all is probably the cloud. Still is.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You can steal that. Can you tweet that?
Sure.
Okay. Just
of course.
Listen, if I can make benchmark people laugh, basically my work is done. You can talk to a lot smarter people than me. So that brings me to search, right? If the cloud is endless, the reason I love Elastic, you know, I don't want you to get into the details because you're on the board. The reason I love Elastic is just mentally, if I think of Google and search, and then I think of the TAM trap in cloud, I'm like, doesn't search become the most important part of this? So like companies as small as Stocktwits use Elastic. So walk me through Elastic, how that came to you at NEA and what you love about it and the company, and they're in Amsterdam and like the whole is, you know, take as long as you want. Just want to hear about Elastic.
So I initially met Elastic in 2013. I met Shai and Steven in May of 2013 and then joined the board in 2014. And the initial idea that Shai had when he created Elasticsearch was that as companies were using more software, both on-premise and on cloud, the number of data sources that you wanted to make sense of was growing exponentially. And if you had two data sources that you needed to make sense of, it was pretty easy to sort of use custom integrations and custom analytics products to make that work. And then the minute you had sort of five data sources you wanted to make sense of, it wasn't sort of five connections you needed. It was actually like five factorial connections you needed. And that was the inspiration, which was that the original Elk stack way back in the day was that you were able to integrate Elasticsearch, which was this very powerful meta search engine that was leveraging reverse index, and then the two layers underneath it and above it. So you had Logstash, which was a digestion engine. Then you had Kibana, which was the visualization engine, and sort of creating a very integrated product where you can digest, search, and visualize using a stack was a very powerful idea. And that was the initial thesis around it. And what was pretty amazing at Elastic was that as soon as sort of like that product started hitting its stride, the developer adoption of it in the early days was just massive. And we talk about it a lot in our S1, in that the sort of developer adoption of Elasticsearch and Logstash and Kibana and the different open source products that we had, the Elastic stack, if you will, was really rapid and continues to be really impressive, frankly. And I think that's sort of a really important part of how Elastic became the company it is that it developer momentum in the early days and a lot of excitement around its use cases kind of pulled it into places where it could go monetize. And so I think that it does get a lot of analogies to Google. And I actually think it's like completely different. Like, obviously, Google is like scanning the public internet, and the amount of data that's on the public internet is massive, and they're able to monetize it through ads. I think Elastic is a completely different sort of view on it, which is that enterprises have a ton of data and they need to make sense of it. But of course, monetization is through, if you're using Elastic Cloud, it's on a usage basis. And if you're using it on-prem, you're paying sort of a license for it. And so while Google goes after sort of the global ad market, you know, Elastic is going after a completely different market, which I think is, there's like orders of magnitude difference. But, you know, as a company, they're still going after those opportunities. And I think there's continues to be a lot of them.
Oh, it's just unbelievable. Like, you know, I just look at Stocktwits and I'm like, that's when I learned about the company is just, you know, it was just listening. You know, I think I probably read the S1. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Stocktwits should be using that. And, you know, as much as Google probably indexes Stocktwits, Elastic allows us to, or our users, to figure out what's happening on Stocktwits in real time as well with search. So it's just an amazing, I mean, I don't know what, and then when Amazon came out and theoretically dropped their name, and this is what Amazon does, right? Whether it's cameras or e-commerce, any kind of e-commerce, they're doing the same thing now. And they kind of held back Elastic for a year by saying, we're going to give that away for free, basically. Is that kind of the stress of open source, is just misinformation and the fact that you've got to constantly be investing to stay ahead, like you said with Mongo?
I think one of the things that has really come to the forefront in the cloud market, and it's especially become to the forefront for public investors, is the interplay between the public cloud vendors themselves and the open source companies. And how do they sort of, do they compete? Do they cooperate? How does it work? And I think one of the things that is pretty obvious today is if you look at what Microsoft and Google are doing, which is, especially from a Microsoft perspective, completely ironic, and I'll sort of explain why, which is, you know, for a company that previously called open source in the form of Linux a cancer, they've completely embraced the next generation of open source and have like kind of gone all in on it, which is, I think, as somebody that's been a developer or has been in this world for quite some time, you kind of look at that and you're like, Microsoft? Really? Like, they're the ones that are completely embracing open source? That's surprising. And so if you look at how much Microsoft, for example, has leaned into open source and how much Google has leaned into open source, and with creating partnerships with all the underlying open source companies and then creating first-party offerings on their cloud that are provided by the commercial entity behind the original open source project to offer a sort of a completely differentiated offering on their clouds, was a really smart move on behalf of both of them coming from a challenger spot to AWS. I think one of the things that's particularly interesting is if you look at how AWS has monetized other open source projects like MySQL or Postgres or anything like that, like they've made a lot of business on open source projects that aren't supported by sort of any other commercial entity. I do think when there is a very strong commercial entity behind an open source product, the other vendors, the other cloud vendors end up becoming your allies if Amazon ends up becoming a competitor. And so I think that it's just a really fascinating market. And it goes back to like what I was saying earlier, which is that we just don't know what ends up happening here. So in fiscal 2020, Elastic, we reported a little over $400 million of revenue, growing, call it 57% year over year. Our SaaS revenue.
Wow.
Yeah, our SaaS revenue was, which is our cloud offering, was $92 million. And that grew a little, 101% year over year. And on a constant currency basis, it grew 109%. So one of the things that I would say is that these markets continue to be pretty early, and we just don't know sort of the end state yet. And I think that's kind of the fog of this entire market. And part of the reason why, you know, I think public investors also, and especially public sell side analysts, struggle to sort of articulate this, which is that we're sort of going into this not really understanding how big these markets actually are. We do know that they're deep. We do know we're in the early days, but we just don't know how high is actually high.
Yeah. Open source is really fascinating. So you and I are going to start an ETF. Well, no, we're not. But if we were, and split it 90-10 for me, because it's my idea, but we can name it Chatham Open Source ETF. What, are there 10 companies that are public yet that are pure enough to be in an ETF?
No, not yet. I do think one of the interesting things that's happened in open source is that until the current generation of companies, the last generation of companies were never actually allowed to get big. And, you know, an open source project like a SpringSource or something like that would get a bunch of momentum and somebody would just come gobble it up. And, you know, SpringSource obviously got bought by VMware. And so there were the sort of last generation of open source companies all got gobbled up before they were actually allowed to get big and we were allowed to see their potential. And there was a unique window from basically 2007 to now where a bunch of these open source companies didn't get acquired for whatever reason. And they all got to go be independent for a while. So if you look at Mongo, got to be independent. Elastic continues to be independent. MuleSoft was independent for a bunch of time, but then got bought by Salesforce. And, you know, I tweeted about this a few weeks ago, which was that I think MuleSoft is actually one of the best acquisitions, if not the best acquisition in Salesforce's history. They bought it for $6.5 million when the company was a little over $300 million of run rate. And it actually accelerated and grew 100% year over year in terms of revenue run rate under Salesforce and, you know, ended a year later at $724 million run rate. And then now it's likely well over $1 billion of revenue run rate inside of Salesforce. And so that $6.5 billion acquisition price in 2018, in retrospect, looks brilliant. And if you look at Salesforce, their platform business is now their biggest business. And it's clear that I think they even talk about it publicly about how much the platform business means to them going forward. And so, you know, and then you have a company like Acquia, which was an independent company, and then Vista bought it. So it was private equity. So it's still independent. I would say that these companies are starting to get really big because there was an entire window where a whole bunch of open source companies got to mature and didn't get bought. And then now you're looking at that another crop sort of that's like private and really, really big. And so examples there are companies like Confluent, which my partner Eric is on the board of, and they're behind the open source project Kafka. Companies like HashiCorp, who of course GGB is involved with, and our friend Jeff Richards' firm is involved in. So, you know, I think that there are a whole nother generation of open source companies that are starting to get really, really big, that are private at the moment. And it looks like they're also at over time going to end up becoming public companies. And I think just more and more independent open source companies that are public, that are really healthy businesses, ends up overall being a good thing for the developer ecosystem and the software ecosystem.
Well, I've got a bunch more questions, but I know we got to go and I'll have you back. So, but I wanted to keep this on point. So obviously the market will settle this with supply. Okay. So either, I mean, what makes Salesforce so amazing is they actually chase deals. They don't wait for the markets to correct, right? Like I always say, like, oh, with Mongo or with Elastic, because it's such cutthroat out there and there's so few open source companies, you only can buy them on the dip. Salesforce went out and paid, at the time, top dollar. They paid a premium for MuleSoft. But you know what I mean? So it wasn't like they waited for the market to correct. They just went after it. And I think Benioff has been rewarded over 20 years of being that aggressive with acquisitions, willing to take some zeros in terms of integration and in the future of a sector. I know a few that have happened for this, the type of MuleSoft type winners, which has created an incredible stock. So I guess open source will always have that hanging over them because depends on the founder, right? There's always going to be offers coming for these open source companies because the kings, the planets know how valuable these are.
I do think that that's what's becoming pretty interesting is that eventually everybody wants to be a platform company. And the way to get access to platforms is, and especially developers that are developing on all this stuff, is by looking at open source companies over time. And yeah, I think Salesforce's acquisition of MuleSoft at the time was, if you looked at all the sell side commentary, everybody was like, wow, this is super aggressive because they're paying, call it 20 times revenue run rate in 2018. But one thing that had, I think, underappreciated is that at the time, MuleSoft was growing 60% year over year and was cash flow break even. And so you had a company that was clearly hyper capital efficient, that had figured out sort of open source distribution and had been monetizing super effectively, and sort of had all the ingredients where if you plug it into a larger distribution force, you would see immediate return on invested capital. I think there are players in the enterprise world that and CEOs that are really smart about capital allocation and really understand their power of distribution that are out there essentially, whether they pay top dollar for a large company like MuleSoft and buy something for $6.5 billion, or they're out sort of like acquiring companies much earlier in their life cycle. I do think sort of as more and more companies in enterprise software have aspirations to become platform companies, you're going to have to get into the platforms themselves. And part of what's so interesting to me as an early stage investor and why I continue to be super excited about open source is that developers continue to look for the incremental next thing. And they continue to be very open to new ideas. And I think as long as you're continuing to innovate along that curve, there are going to be continue to be great opportunities to build really awesome companies. And so as these companies continue to mature, like the main thing that I'm doing kind of every day is looking for the next great open source product, the next great infrastructure product, and looking for the next ideas that hopefully we can build over a long period of time in a very sustainable fashion, and then eventually go public and create really big independent companies.
So when I think of open source, I think of money as being the ultimate open source or money transfers. So what is that where Modern Treasury fits in when you're newer company?
Yeah, Modern Treasury does have an open source component to it. And what they're doing is deeply integrating with banks and giving you programmatic access to money movement. And so if you need to either wire out money or wire in money, that process has been largely manual. And there's a lot of analogies to how Twilio gave you programmatic access to the underlying telecom network. There has not been sort of that API access to the underlying commercial bank account that you have that is yours, that you use a lot, but there has been no programmatic way to access it as either a developer or an enterprise or anything like that. And so Modern Treasury, really, that was the idea behind it, was that you can give programmatic access to the underlying commercial banking network. And so they partner with banks and deeply integrate with banks to provide those APIs. And the company has really hit a great stride. And so we invested in the Series A late 2019, and 2020 has been a remarkable year for them. And, you know, they announced a few weeks ago in August, they did $100 million of volume, and they're growing about 25% month over month. And so this continues to be sort of these exciting opportunities where you're giving programmatic access to underlying networks that end up being super, super valuable. But nobody's done sort of the hard work to create APIs on them or sort of access to them. And if somebody comes along and does it, you start creating tremendous value for your customers really fast.
And can you look at B rounds, or you have to be involved from the seed?
Well, we do, but that's like we consider that sort of like an exceptional thing. And so, you know, once in a while, we'll do something beyond a Series A, but that's not the core part of the business.
So to wrap up here, the one thing that's fascinating to me is how good the firm is. And, you know, I've read enough about the firm. You don't look too far in the future, which is why you're willing to talk to guys like me who are stuck trying to wake up in the morning and see what's going on. If you're only investing in five companies a year, what the fuck do you guys do? What kind of racket are you running over the Benchmark? Like, I think I could work there. I got five ideas a year.
I think, you know, you look at sort of the funnel of like what it takes to get to 5 to 10, and then the numbers start getting really big. I think we looked at the number of sort of ideas that we consider or prosecute in a given year to get to 5 to 10 investments, you know, it's a massive number, of course. I also think that we miss, and that just hurts, right? When you pass on something for whatever reason and then it ends up working. And so you make sure you don't do that. And, you know, one of the things is that you have to have sort of your core focuses in areas where you just feel like you bring a lot to the table and just sort of spend a lot of time on that. And then the other part of it is the getting so involved at the very early stages of companies means that you're committing to being a business partner for all of your companies. And that itself is a long and patient journey that you have to embark on. And, you know, the entrepreneurs that we get involved with do amazing work, and they work super, super hard. And so being there to close a candidate, help them recruit their next VP, help them sort of like hire the next great person on the team, create a business development partnership with a strategic player in their market, going and recruiting a potential independent board member, all these things are your day-to-day tasks where it's part of being a board member for every single investment that ends up sort of taking the vast majority of your time.
What's your favorite city? Do you like Amsterdam? That's where Elastic is.
So Elastic was founded in Amsterdam. Then they moved. So most of their management team is in Mountain View now. And then the engineering team is 100% distributed. I think that's a pretty interesting thing that we're all starting to explore now in this new COVID world, is that as companies have been forced to become remote, those that were already remote are having to deal with the fact that their remote employees are not at work during work hours. They're at home during work hours and their entire family is with them. And so that's created its own challenges. And then the companies that were working in an office now are experimenting with remote and how that's what that means. And so I don't quite know what it means in terms of how startups are going to look like in the future. I do think that there are some companies that have transitioned to remote and probably not coming back into an office because you know, their employees, you know, especially people with families that have decided they didn't wanted more space or wanted to be closer to relatives or something like that and have left an area, they're probably not coming back. And that's okay. And so you just sort of adjust to it and move along. And so still today, you know, I still think Bay Area is just a terrific place for innovation and technology. And at the same time, I think you're going to start to see really promising pockets of innovation elsewhere. You know, I think in the US, of course, like LA and Austin and New York have been known to be great places. I think one of the cities that's like really promising right now is Atlanta. You know, we're seeing a lot of really cool stuff in Atlanta at the moment. And then our neighbors to the north, there's a lot of really cool stuff happening in Toronto. And I think certainly Europe, places like Amsterdam and Berlin and London have also been really terrific places for founders.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, listen, the podcasts are fun because, listen, I got an audience that like loves public stocks, but I think they really need to understand what venture capitalists are thinking about, because this is like a monster trend, open source. Now, a lot of companies could get bought, that planets could just buy up everything, but they still have to understand how big open source is, because, you know, if planets like Salesforce are buying companies like MuleSoft, I think that's what can lead to these giant gaps. You know, forgetting we're in zero interest rate world and my government's printing money and Salesforce got added to the Dow, but the fact that they can buy something at 20 times sales and turn it into a great growth vehicle at the size that Salesforce is, says something about what this TAM trap is and what the analysts on Wall Street, you know, you talk a lot about Excel and I'm like, I don't think Excel matters anymore in a cloud world because the columns can't be made big enough for the zeros.
Right.
And it's just like, fascinates me that we're in a world more about, well, I can't figure it out. I just don't trust any analysts. It's like the market structure because of these type of cloud companies and then COVID have changed everything. Final question. What happens if 30 great open source guys come to you? Do you really can only do five companies a year? If like three great ones in a row walk in at the seed level that are in your sweet spot, do you break the rule and do three? Or do you say, I got to pick one?
No, if three sort of are great. And remember, it's a double opt-in. So it's not only that we want to invest, the entrepreneurs then have to want to work with us too. And so, if three in a row happens in like three and all three come in on the same week, like, let's do them. Let's get to work.
All right. Under that note, I have two that I'm sending your way that I'm already in. Great. So you'll just make me rich. So we'll just have a little secret handshake. Do you have a question for Ross? I have Ross Mason today. Do you have a question for Ross?
I mean, Ross is incredible. I think one of the things that is always really terrific to hear from Ross is the long journey from founding MuleSoft to when it inflected. And there was this gigantic period, call it from 2007 to probably like 2012 when the company actually inflected. So there were these like really five tough years of product innovation and methodical sort of market investigation and working with your customers that we often forget when we look at sort of what happened at the company from 2013 to 2018. So sort of the first 5 to 6 years are sort of like, is the story that is, I think, not often told, but the last 5 years of that company, which just is terrific and extraordinary, would not have happened without all the hard work they did for the first 5 years, where it was painful. And I mean, if you talk to Ross about it, like, I think those are stories that I find to be super, super interesting is people that are doing this sort of like slow compounding of the product itself, which then allows for this amazing business to be built later on. And that's sort of kind of under the radar, and sort of that slow compounding effect that comes about is something that we often talk about public stocks, but it's also happening in private markets where somebody's just doing it very incrementally and methodically. And after 5 or 6 years, they have this like amazing product that now can actually inflect. And so hearing that, the stuff that Ross saw and the decisions that Ross and Greg made together in the early days of MuleSoft, I think would be really terrific for your listeners to hear.
Okay, this is great. I think this is better than Patrick's podcast. Well, Patrick won't listen, so what do you think?
Now you just have to have me on. Like, I've been on Patrick's podcast, I think, 3 times. So when are you going to have me on next?
I have a way deeper roster of people that want to talk to me. So this is it. This will be the one and only. This has been fun for me. It's a little bit still over my head, but I appreciate you kind of sticking it out with me. I mean, Benchmark's just a fascinating firm. Venture capital is so fascinating. The way the public and private markets, you know, this is my episode. This is what I do. It's like connecting the private and public markets because I invest at the early stage. And then I obviously own momentum companies where I don't believe in the Excel spreadsheet. I just believe in the possibilities and the liquidity. So I'm trying to piece all that together and try and see how publics are connected to the early stage and how early stage are connected to the publics. And I think they're very connected. I haven't been able to put it into graph form. I just visually see it. I appreciate you taking time to do this for me. And I can't wait to get you back on. So I appreciate the time today.
Thank you, Howard. It was terrific to be on.
All right. Talk to you soon. Canute.
Hey.
What do you think? Learn a little bit there?
A lot. These guys are so bright.
It's crazy. Cray cray. And they spend time trying to teach us, right? Like, this is different.
I know.
They're not like with semiconductors back in the original VC day, it was all, you know, kind of the behind the wall. The VCs today are like open book, right? There's just so much flow and everybody's kind of sharing.
I know.
Just this open source of knowledge, kind of like what podcasts are. All right. I know you're a busy day and it's a rare day where we're going to do more podcasts today just because we have some great guests. So I'm going to let you go. Everybody, this is Panic with Friends. Obviously, we did not talk about panic because there is no panic in the open source. There are moments of panic created by the Amazons of the world who say, oh, we're going to come into their space. But overall, the markets just are so big. And as we talked about in this episode, the TAM trap, you know, the cloud is just endless right now. You can find Panic with Friends, go subscribe on Spotify and Apple or Google if you have an Android and love Google Podcasts. If you like what I have to say about stocks and markets, I have a free blog, howardlinzen.com. Thanks, Canute, for producing it and StockTwits for distributing it and letting me do this. I will talk to everybody soon.